This is the sixth day of this January 2017 Rohatsu 7-day Sesshin. We'll take one more day from our text of the last couple of days, the letters and lectures of Chinese Zen master Da Wei from the 12th century. And it's the book is called Swampland Flowers, translated by Christopher Cleary. We left off yesterday reading from a letter in which he was emphasizing the importance of faith. And we'll pick up there. In the teachings, there are clear passages like the above. How could Buddha deceive people? If you're half light and half dark, half believing and half not believing, then whenever you meet with situations and encounter circumstances, your mind produces doubt and confusion. This is mind having attachments to objects. Not being able to be definite and have no doubts about this path, to destroy the root of affliction and get away from all difficulty, is entirely due to lack of settled faith, to being confused by the delusions of one's own personal existence. Half light and half believing and half not believing. Probably until very far into this Dharma, we're all some mix of believing and not believing. The further we go, the more our experience and practice confirms the truth of the Dharma, and our faith grows, and that growth nourishes more practice, more sitting, which grows more faith. Kensho is having it confirmed to the point where you know. Even then, I suppose there could be doubts, some kind of doubts afterward, but they can't get any traction. They're just old tapes running in the mind. There's an old saying in Zen about how even awakening still leaves work to be done, habit forces that still are active in the mind. It just goes like this. The wind ceases, but the waves still surge. This is a letter to an imperial official. When the last day of your life arrives, neither love, nor power, nor riches, nor innate spirit, nor official position, nor wealth and rank will be of any use. When the vision fails, there are only the realms of two paths that appear, one and one. The paths of doing good and doing harm during your life. If you've done much harm and little good, then you're swept away according to your evil deeds. If you've done much good and little harm, then you are born according to your good deeds as a god or human in the house of the 10 virtues. God or human, these are the two highest of the six realms of unenlightened existence. God, what he translates as God is what we know here as a deva, someone born into a great privilege and ease, a life of ease. which I would say, compared to most human beings, a lot of us here have that. Once you know that these two roads are both in the province of empty illusion, then you generate a mind firm and unflinching, zealous and vigorously advancing to transcend feelings and detach from views and penetrate through and out of birth and death. Then on the last day of your life, the two roads, good and evil, will not be able to hold you. So notice, even that the road of good will not be able to hold you. Will not be able to hold she or he who has seen beyond good and evil, beyond conditions, changing conditions. This phrase, to transcend feelings, does not mean to deny feelings, doesn't mean to not experience feelings, only to not get bogged down in feelings. To detach from views is to be able to detach from the way we frame reality, our belief systems, to get some perspective, some distance from our projections. One of the main themes of the Lankavatara Sutra, Bodhidharma's favorite sutra, is that all of our perceptions are the projection of our own mind. Everything we perceive is through a filter, a prism that we've projected. This is becoming so dramatically obvious just in the last few years, as more and more people talk about we've reached an era post fact, that facts no longer matter as much as they used to, because people simply believe what they believe. A longer letter to another, I don't even know if it's a man or woman, doesn't matter, Li Han Lao. You report that since you got back to the city, where you wear clothes and eat food and enjoy your family, where everything is as before, since you've lost the feeling of being tied down and aren't thinking of it as extraordinary, the former obstructions of your old habits have diminished and become slight. Again and again, you say you're leaping with joy. I imagine this as we might feel coming out of Sashin, getting back to our busy lives, and there is this afterburn that can be so wonderful in the days after Sashin. He says this is the result of practicing the Dharma. If you are not great beyond measure, understanding 100 and handling 1,000 properly in a single laugh, then you cannot know that in our family, I think that means in our school, in Zen, there is indeed a subtle marvel not transmitted. Otherwise, you'll never be able to destroy the two words doubt and wrath till the end of time. It wouldn't help even if the sky became my mouth and grass. It wouldn't help even if the sky became my mouth, and grass, trees, pebbles, and stones all emitted light to help me expound the truth. So he's saying there is this, that which cannot be taught. Thus we believe that this thing cannot be transmitted and cannot be studied. It requires one's own realization and enlightenment, one's own approval and stopping. Only then does one reach the end. Your one laugh right now abruptly obliterates attainment. What else is there to say? That is, reaching that very advanced state and having it show in a laugh just frees us from any notion of having gotten anything. I don't get the translator's choice of the word wrath. Otherwise, you'll never be able to destroy the two words doubt and wrath till the end of time. Doubt surely is one of the most formidable hindrances in practice, and probably no one has ever been. It's probably never been someone who hasn't faced doubt in practice. Wrath. He continues, old yellow face, he's referring to the Buddha. It's very much in the Zen style of rather than having this worshipful stance toward the Buddha and the masters, the real masters will sometimes make them more accessible, more within reach by using terms like that. Old Yellowface said, I don't cling to what sentient beings say. It's all conditioned phenomena, empty and false. Though I don't depend on words to speak, I also don't use wordlessness to teach. And then Da Wei comments, what you said in your letter, that you've lost the feeling of constraint and haven't been entertaining thoughts of the extraordinary, tacitly accords with what old Yellowface said. What's identical to this talk is called enlightened talk. What's apart from it is called deluded talk. My whole life I've had a great vow that I'd rather suffer the pains of hell with this body on behalf of all sentient beings than portray the Buddha Dharma with this mouth as a human sentiment and blind people's eyes. In other words, not getting beyond the realm of feeling and subjectivity. Just at this very instant, I got a little insight into what bothers me about magazines like Tricycle, these national Buddhist magazines, which I've heard many people are put off with in a certain way. I've never been able to quite understand or articulate what I find off-putting about it. But this word human sentiment, I think the pages are just full of human sentiment, not just the big splashy ads for finding romance through some kind of program that's got the word Dharma in it or something. But a lot of other things. He continues, since you've gotten to this stage, and know for yourself that this thing is not obtained from others, just go on as before for a while. No need to ask any more if you understand the great Dharma or not, or if you are obstructed or not as you respond to potentialities. If you entertain such notions, then you're not as before. So let's say he's talking that the recipient of this letter has entered the first gate, to use the Chinese phrase, has gotten through her or his koan, and Dawei is advising him, just go on as before for a while. No need to ask anymore if you understand the great Dharma or not, or if you're obstructed or not. That's he says, it's just entertaining notions. It can be quite unsettling after passing one's first koan, because one finds oneself on uncertain footing. Uncertain because it's unfamiliar, and one maybe has heard stories of the great enlightenments of the masters, and it doesn't measure up to that at all. I think what he's offering is good advice, and what a Dharma brother gave me after I got through Mu is don't think about it. That's where you get into trouble. It's that same old mistake of thinking in terms of the awakened and the unawakened. Just go on as before for a while. Forget about it. That's we get that in this other Chinese saying, having some attainment is the jackal's yelp, having no attainment is the lion's roar. It really means having gotten beyond any notion of being special, of having achieved anything, which is healthy because one hasn't achieved anything. There's nothing to attain. One's just opened one's eyes. Or not even that. One's eyes have been opened. It's not something that you do or that I do. It's just what happens. He continues, I take it that after the summer you can come back here. This pleases me very much. If you are still so eager, frantically seeking without respite, then this wouldn't do. Seeing the great extent of your joy the last few days, I didn't presume to comment, fearing my words would give offense. Now that your joy has settled, I'll dare to point something out. With this affair, it's extremely important that you don't take it easy. To get it right, you must feel shame. Let's stop and comment on that. You know, shame has such a bad name in our own culture, but it's a great engine of motivation in Asia to feel unworthy of whatever your station is, whatever you've reached, because implied in that is that I could do more, I could go further. That's really what he's saying. To get it right, you must feel shame. You must recognize that there is so much further to go, and that none of us, no matter where we are in this beginningless, endless path, can afford to become complacent, much less proud. He continues, frequently those with sharp faculties and superior wisdom attain it without expending a lot of effort, so they think of taking it easy and therefore don't cultivate it. In other words, don't keep developing whatever little insight they've had. Don't keep practicing. Many are carried off by the objects before them, so they cannot be the master. This is getting lost in worldly concerns and pleasures. As days and months pass, they're deluded and don't turn back. Since their power in the way cannot subdue the power of their actions, delusion gets its way. They're sure to be controlled by delusive demons. When faced with the end of their lives, they won't have gained power. So with an initial kensho, if one stops practicing, then that little aperture that had opened up can close up again over time. This is what happened to Flora Courtois. Some of you know this is a woman from the 1940s who came to a spontaneous awakening. Didn't know it at the time, and felt like on cloud nine for weeks or months, but she'd had no practice. She'd never even heard of the word Zen. And so, without practicing, over time, old habit forces that hadn't been completely unearthed because she hadn't had full enlightenment, these old habit forces reasserted themselves, and she became, she said, proud and full of herself. And then she had the good karma to run into, 25 years later, run into Yasutani Roshi in California. And he confirmed as much as he could 25 years later that what she had was a genuine awakening. And then she began with Zen practice. And that's the last I heard about her. So Dawei continues, be sure to remember the words of a previous day. I guess that means a previous time. In principle, I think Dawei has a lot of trouble remembering in his quotes. He remembers the quotes, but not the names of who said them. I can sympathize with him. Here's the quote. In principle, it's sudden enlightenment. Taking advantage of enlightenment to clear everything away. In the event, phenomena are not suddenly removed, but exhausted gradually. And then he comments, whether you're walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, you must not forget. As for all the different kinds of sayings of the ancients, like koans, don't consider them true and don't consider them false. Over a long time, as you become completely ripe, naturally you will reach silent accord with your own fundamental mind. You don't have to seek special excellence or extraordinary wonders besides these. When he says you must not forget, he's saying just what we all know in Sesshin for sure, is to make the practice continuous. Continuous as we leave the Zendo, continuous through break periods, rest, work, meals. Master Shui Lao asked Ma Zu, what is the true meaning of the coming from the West? Ma Zu then knocked him down with a kick to the chest. At that, Shui Lao was greatly enlightened. He got up, clapping his hands and laughing loudly, and said, how extraordinary! How wonderful! Instantly, on the tip of a hair, I've understood the root source of myriad states of concentration and countless subtle meanings. Then he bowed and withdrew. Afterwards, he would tell the assembly, from the time I took Ma Zu's kick up until now, I haven't stopped laughing. The joke, of course, is discovering that what we've been searching for all along was our very own mind. That we've been like one in water crying, "I thirst." One day, Kushan approached Shui Feng. Feng knew his circumstances were ripe, so he knew that Kushan was ripe. So he suddenly got up, held him tight, and said, "What is it?" Opening up, Kushan was completely enlightened. He even forgot his comprehending mind and just raised his hand and waved, nothing more. Feng said, "Will you express some principle?" Kushan said, "How could there be any principle?" Here's another short letter. "Recently it's been hot and humid. I wonder whether or not in your retreat you've been relaxed and open and naturally so, without being disturbed by all the demons of delusion. Whether or not within your daily activities and conduct you've become one with the koan mu. Whether or not you are able to make no distinction between motion and stillness. Whether or not you've merged dreaming and wakefulness. Whether or not you've joined inner truth and outer phenomena. Whether or not for you mind and objects are all thus." And he quotes Layman Pong, famous and deeply enlightened layman in China. "Mind is thus and objects are also thus. There is no true and also no false. Existence doesn't concern me, nor does non-existence hold me. I'm not a holy sage, but an ordinary fellow who understands things." And then Dawei says, "If you can truly be an ordinary fellow who's understood things, then what mudballs are Shakyamuni and Bodhidharma? What a warm bowl of noise are the teachings of the canon of the three vehicles." In other words, how far the direct experience surpasses anything in doctrine. Here's another letter. "Our great Buddhist sages could empty out all characteristics and achieve knowledge of the myriad things, but even they could not instantly obliterate what was fixed by their actions. So how could commonplace ordinary people?" I think he's saying even the great masters could not wipe out the effects of past deeds. "Since you are one of them, layman, I think you too should enter this state of concentration that I'm about to indicate. In times past, there was a monk who asked an old master, 'The world is so hot, I don't know where to go to escape.' The old master said, escape into a boiling cauldron, into the coals of a furnace. The monk said, in a cauldron of boiling water or the coals of a furnace, how does one escape? The adept said, the master said, the multitude of sufferings cannot reach there. Brings to mind a koan in the Blue Cliff Record where a monk asks, how can I escape the heat and the cold? And the master says, go where there is no heat and cold. And he says, where is that? And the master says, when it's hot, let the heat kill you. When it's cold, let the cold kill you. We could add to that, when you have physical pain while sitting, let the pain kill you. Meaning, become so thoroughly merged with the pain that there's no pain apart from you, no you apart from the pain. And then Dawei himself says, I hope that in the conduct of your daily activities, you will meditate just like this. The advice of old masters shouldn't be neglected. And he continues, this is my own prescription for getting results. I wouldn't consent to pass it on to you freely unless this path accorded with you and you were acquainted with this mind. It just takes a moment when the accord with the path is crude. Being in the boiling water, you don't need to use any other boiling water. If he uses some other boiling water, this makes the person go mad. You must realize this. One moment when the accord is crude, don't look elsewhere, just in your daily activities and conduct as a layman. Where bright, it's as bright as the sun. Where dark, it's as dark as lacquer. If, wherever you pick it up, you reflect on it uniformly with a light of the fundamental ground, there's no going wrong. You can kill people and you can bring people to life. Therefore, the Buddhas and patriarchs have always gone into the boiling cauldron, into the coals of the furnace, using this medicine to cure birth and death, the great disease that afflicts sentient beings with suffering. They are called the great kings of physicians. I don't know whether you fully believe it or not, layman. If you say you possess a secret method not handed down from father to son, a subtle technique that doesn't use going into the boiling cauldron, into the coals of a furnace to escape, then I hope you'll bestow it on me. What I take this from this is, if you can find a better medicine than oneness, becoming absolutely concentrated to the point of self-forgetfulness, then I'd want to hear about it. This practice is so simple in what we need to do. It's so uncomplicated. Things are, in their nature, indivisible. All things, all phenomena are just this one mind. And what prevents us from seeing that is just this discriminating mind that, yes, discriminates, that creates the illusion of separation, of subject and object. Our only task is to merge completely with the practice we're working on. Utterly, 100%, absolutely. It's no better medicine than this, to re-experience the fundamental unity of all existences, and through that to find liberation from the tyranny of the self, the misery of division, self and other, us and them, and all the others, right and wrong, success and failure, on and on and on, this bifurcated world that human beings slog through lifetime after lifetime. But confirm it. Find it out for yourself. Another letter. Now that you have taken up this matter, you must steadfastly make yourself thoroughgoing and sit upright in a room with what you've truly experienced and awakened to in the course of your life. It's like crossing a bridge made of a single plank carrying a 200-pound burden. If your hands and feet slip, you can't even preserve your own life, much less save others. An ancient worthy said, "This matter is like an old man of 80 taking the stage. How could it be child's play?" Another ancient worthy said, "If I propagated the teaching of the school the same way all the time, the weeds in front of the Dharma hall would be 10 feet deep. Better have someone check the courtyard." He seems to be offering kind of random quotes here. This one, though, if I propagated the teaching same way all the time, the weeds in front of the Dharma hall would be 10 feet deep. What a betrayal of the Dharma to have perfect consistency in one's teaching, or to express it in the same way all the time. When monks came seeking the way, Mu Chao would say, "An obvious case, I forgive you 30 blows." Wu Ye of Fenyang told questioners, "No false thinking." So he's giving the different variety of responses that different teachers offer when approached by students. And then one last one. Whenever Lu Zhu saw a monk enter the gate, he would immediately turn around and sit facing the wall. When helping others, you must not dim this style. Only then do you not lose the meaning of this school, which has come down from antiquity. So the freedom to adapt, or to show, to express what one has realized differently in accordance with the particular person and the circumstances, rather than clinging to some rigid principle. This is really, really out there. It's famous for its uniqueness. This master, who whenever he saw a monk coming in, would just turn around and sit facing the wall. For some, that would work. For others, not. So this is a real principle of teaching, not just in Zen, but in anywhere, in any walk of life. Academic teaching is, it's not just a matter of the teacher's abilities, or even of the student's abilities, but it's that teacher with that student at that time is the measure of things. No doubt there were some who came in who, when this Lu Zhu turned his back, found that suited them and they stayed, and others who wanted something more than that minimalist teaching, and they left and found another more conventional teacher. Here he has one last letter it says Master Kui. Sounds like it's a Zen teacher. He's writing, "Now that you've obtained outside support," that may mean enough financial support to get a temple up and running, "you're thinking that you can put aside human affairs and do Buddhist things all the time with the monks. Over a long time, as you become especially excellent, you can expect furthermore to conduct detailed examinations with them in your room." Doksan. "You must not tolerate human feelings or fall into the weeds with them. Instruct them directly with your own provisions and teach them to awaken and attain for themselves. Only then will it be the way venerable practitioners help others. If you see them lingering in doubt without comprehending, and so you add footnotes for them, not only do you blind their eyes, but also you lose the proper method of your own family," that is, of Zen. Said strong, solid advice for teaching in Zen. You must not tolerate human feelings. The way I take that is not to get soft and worry about the students, the pain that comes to the student from her or his not awakening. It's a real danger because, of course, any teacher has such sympathies for the student. Any teacher has been through that anguish of going to Sesshin over and over. Maybe not any teacher, but almost all teachers have gone through that, and the disappointment and the frustration over and over and over and over again. Most of us, not to the extent that Eitken Roshi, the late Eitken Roshi, did, where he worked on Mu for 26 years before he was passed on Mu. To be fair, he said that half of that he was just doing it intermittently, working on Mu. But to not give way to this sympathy to the extent that you're giving away too much to the student. It's a very, very hard thing, but exceedingly important. "You must not tolerate human feelings or fall into the weeds with them." It's a betrayal of faith in the student to want to help them too much. It's saying, okay, you can't really do it yourself, so here, let me do it for you. And teach them, he says, and teach them to awaken and attain for themselves. If you see them lingering in doubt without comprehending, in other words, being still caught in lack of understanding and the pain of not knowing, and so you add footnotes for them. I don't take this literally. If you try to steer them too much or go in that way, not only do you blind their eyes, but also you lose the proper method of the Zen school. It There are so many signs of Zen, the rigor of Zen declining, and people becoming teachers after a few years, and the koan system being misused, where people are being passed too easily. It's nothing more important than to hold the line on this for the student's sake, first of all, and for the sake of our tradition. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. Beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind masses. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind masses. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.